It's Friday, March 17, 2017. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Justice Samuel Alito of the United States Supreme Court on Wednesday night of this week addressed a group of Catholic lawyers, and to them, he delivered a bracing message. It's a message we all need to hear. This sitting justice of the U.S. Supreme Court told the lawyers, quote, a wind is picking up that is hostile to those with traditional moral beliefs, end quote. As major media noted, Justice Alito, to the lawyers, read several sections from his dissenting opinion in the Obergefell decision. That's the decision in which he was in the minority on the court. The 5-4 majority voted in favor of legalizing same-sex marriage in all 50 states and imposing that redefinition of marriage on the entire nation. Justice Alito has served on the Supreme Court since 2006. Previous to that, he sat on a Circuit Court of Appeals of the United States, and he also served as a United States attorney, in both cases in the state of New Jersey. He returned to that state in order to speak to this group of Catholic lawyers, and he warned them quite publicly that there is now this stiff wind that is blowing against anyone who would hold to a traditional sexual morality. Justice Alito, referencing his dissenting opinion, said that the decision legalizing same-sex marriage would be used to, quote, vilify those who disagree and treat them as bigots, end quote. Speaking on Wednesday night, Justice Alito said, we are seeing this is coming to pass. He then cited Bob Dylan's song lyric, quote, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows, end quote. Now, there are several very interesting dimensions to this story. First of all, justices, most of them, with the rare exception especially of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, try to avoid public scrutiny in terms of their speeches and comments. They try to be non-controversial in terms of their public appearances, precisely because they want to be very clear about their role as justices of the Supreme Court. To make that matter very pointed, justices of the Supreme Court prefer to speak through the formal format of their opinions handed down from the court, written opinions that become a part of the court's tradition and a part of the public record. It takes a great deal, therefore, for a justice of the Supreme Court to speak in the open about a matter of such urgent concern. But it's clear that Justice Alito is very concerned. Back in his dissenting opinion in the Obergefell decision from 2015, Justice Alito was indeed very clear, and we now know very prophetic, about what he saw in terms of these winds of hostility coming to those who hold to traditional religious beliefs. In that dissenting opinion, Justice Alito demonstrated a very clear logic. Those who are pressing for the legalization of same-sex marriage are not pressing merely for what they describe as a right for members of the same sex to get married. They are pressing for the normalization of all same-sex relationships and the honoring of those relationships throughout the entire culture. That statement, throughout the entire culture, becomes absolutely crucial because that means not only in America's public institutions, not only enshrined in law, but hammered throughout the entire culture. And that means throughout colleges and universities, inevitably including Christian colleges and universities, throughout schools, and that means schools at every level, and that would include Christian schools. It would also include schools in which very young children are involved. It would mean pressing this agenda of the normalization of homosexuality and homosexual relationships throughout every vocation and every profession. Florists, cake bakers, and photographers will have to join the moral revolution or go out of business. All of that was what Justice Alito warned back in 2015. And in issuing this warning, Justice Alito was not alone. Back in 2015, the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, issued his own separate dissenting opinion in which he issued similar kinds of warnings. And together, the Chief Justice and Justice Alito, in terms of the oral arguments for the case, put the then Solicitor General of the United States, arguing for the judicial imposition of same-sex marriage in all 50 states, very much on the line when both of them pressed the Solicitor General about whether or not religious institutions, in particular religious colleges and schools, would be required to revise their own moral codes and standards for hiring and admissions and housing on the basis of the Obergefell decision. You may recall, quite chillingly, that the Solicitor General of the United States then, Donald Verrilli, said it will be an issue. Justice Alito, speaking to these lawyers on Wednesday night, said it is now an issue. The winds that he warned of in 2015 are now blowing at gale force in this culture. Another interesting dimension of the story is that Justice Alito gave these lawyers a particular warning, a warning that religious liberty claims may find an unusually chilly reception before federal courts. He explained that Congress and public opinion is actually far more friendly to religious liberty than the courts. The really chilling part of that is that it is the courts, constitutionally speaking, who are actually assigned the responsibility to defend our constitutional freedoms. The first freedom being freedom of religion. That is, the freedom of the free exercise of religion. Speaking to these lawyers on Wednesday night, Justice Alito concluded, quote, "We are likely to see pitched battles in courts and Congress, state legislatures, and town halls. But the most important fight is for the hearts and minds of our fellow Americans. It is up to all of us to evangelize our fellow Americans about the issue of religious freedom," end quote. That's an interesting verb for a Supreme Court justice to use, but it reflects the urgency that he clearly feels behind his concern. But you also notice that he understands where the real fight is. Interestingly, reflecting a certain humility not found always amongst the judiciary, here you have a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court who says the biggest battle is not the battle before his own court. It is the court of public opinion, the court reflected in the hearts and minds of fellow Americans. Ominously, this justice does warn us of what he called pitched battles to come, and we already see this. We've seen it state by state, issue by issue, vocation by vocation. Perhaps before long, we will see it institution by institution, college by college, school by school. In any event, we cannot say that we were not warned, and it should tell us something, that a sitting justice of the United States Supreme Court, speaking in what he knew would be reported to the public, Wednesday night of this week declared that the winds of hostility are now blowing against anyone who would hold to traditional moral beliefs. You'll recall that the justice cited Bob Dylan to the effect that you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. That's especially true when you're facing the wind yourself. And this is a wind that is already blowing, and it's blowing at us. Next, we shift to two stories, both of them reflecting the redefinition of marriage and parenthood, and furthermore, by extension, the redefinition of what it means to be human. In both cases, the same math is found. One child, three parents. In one of these stories, it has to do with biology. In the other story, it has to do with the law. Both of them urgently important. First of all, in the Chicago Tribune, reporting from Great Britain, Maria Ching writes, quote, "Britain's Newcastle University says its scientists have received a license to create babies using DNA from three people to prevent women from passing on potentially fatal genetic diseases to their children, the first time such approval has been granted." She goes on to say the license was granted Thursday, that's yesterday, by the country's fertility regulator, that according to Newcastle University. We're also reminded that in December, British officials approved what was defined as the cautious use of the techniques, which aim, we are told, to fix problems linked to mitochondria, the energy-producing structures inside a cell's nucleus. Faulty mitochondria, we are told, can result in conditions including muscular dystrophy and major organ failure, end quote. Well, here again, we see the promise that some kind of new DNA technology, a technology related to the human embryo, can resolve an existing medical problem. We understand that the medical problems are real, but we also need to understand the danger in this announcement. Here you have the reproductive authority in Great Britain granting a license to scientists at Newcastle University to create one child from three parents. The three parents will come down this way. It will be one male parent, and then it will be two female parents. The two female parents will include the parent giving the egg and the parent who will eventually give the cell structure that will include the nucleus. This means that mitochondria from a third parent will be included in the DNA structure of the resulting child. That might sound like something of a genetic technicality, but what it really means is that we will be tampering with the human embryo in order to introduce into a child who would biologically have two parents DNA from a third parent. And what makes that particularly important is that this will be heritable, which means any change in the genetic structure of the child will be passed on when the child reproduces. There can be no doubt that the resulting child would have its primary DNA from the mother and the father, but there would be this third party whose DNA would also become quite permanently a part of the DNA existence, the genetic structure of the child, and then when the child reproduces, passed on generation to generation. Now, it is not at all clear what this will mean, which is to say that there never has been before this kind of tampering with a human embryo, this kind of genetic manipulation in this particular technique. So here we have a government licensing researchers to do this, and it's not exactly clear what will be the result. But whatever the result is, it will not just exist in the life of this child, but will be reproductively reproduced in generations to come. But what this also represents is the opening of a door, the licensing of an experiment that cannot possibly stop here. The argument that is used in this case, as we have seen over and over again, is an argument that will be used in order to authorize the next experiment, to cross the next boundary, to do the next thing after this. And once you cross the boundary of heritable characteristics, once you decide that it's okay to experiment on a human embryo, knowing that whatever results will be passed on to successive generations, you've opened the door inevitably to designer babies. There's a moral distinction here that's really important and has to be recognized. There's no doubt that here there is the authorization to conduct a medical experiment, and it's going to be limited in this case. We take it at face value to trying to prevent the transmission of certain genetic diseases from generation to generation. If that could be prevented in itself, that would be a good thing. But we also need to recognize that there's a cost, a moral cost, to the technology. One of the costs is that it opens the door to further uses of the technology, and this means that the same technology can inevitably be used to create designer babies. And once you create designer babies, you are truly redefining what it means to be human. But at the very least, at the level of genetics, every previous human generation has been the combination of two people and their DNA, not of three. This is a crucial barrier. In essence, it redefines what it means to be human. It may appear to be a very small issue, but it opens a very big door. But a similar door was opened in a story that doesn't come from Britain, but rather in the United States. It comes from the state of New York, where, as we read in the New York Law Journal, quote, calling it the logical extension of the legalization of same-sex marriage and the 2016 expansion of unmarried partners' custody rights in New York, a judge has granted tri-custody of a boy to a man and two women who have all helped raise the youngster. Joel Shishinko reports, Suffolk County Supreme Court Justice H. Patrick Lees III said in his March 8 determination that both biological parents of a child, identified as J.M., have shown their love and concern for the now 10-year-old, but so has the woman named Dawn M., who sought the action seeking the unique tri-custody agreement. We are told that the biological mother of the child supported the other woman's petition for a formal custody arrangement. The two women were romantically involved at the time of the child's birth in 2007. The biological father acceded, we are told, to the child having both mothers listed as mothers when he fathered the child with one of the mothers through natural means. Here we have a further, very ominous redefinition of the family. The family has been defined throughout human history in terms of parentage with a mother and a father. The one thing you could count on in every previous generation of human beings to date is that there was a mother and a father. Biologically, there was no other way to have a child. But now you have having a child redefined not only in terms of reproductive technology, but also in terms of the moral revolution. This Supreme Court justice in the state of New York explicitly cited the Obergefell decision legalizing same-sex marriage and a 2016 law we discussed on the briefing in New York that extends unmarried partners' custody rights in order to set this precedent-making case. So in just a matter of days, two different stories, one concerning biology, the other concerning the law. But as we said, in both of these, the math is the same. For the first time in human history, legally on the one hand, biologically on the other, the math is one child and three parents. Christians looking at this have to understand there's more than merely law and biology going on here. This is a destabilizing of the family. It's a redefining of what it means to have children. It's a redefining of custodial authority and responsibility to children. It is the redefinition of parenthood, where parenthood is no longer, in this case, tied to biology or even to adoption. It is now made a right independent of either biological reproduction or legal adoption. This is a new thing. It's a very dangerous new thing. Interestingly, one of the things we need to note is that the argument in this legal case is that this is the best thing for the child. But even a look at the case itself demonstrates that the guiding issue here, the driving ambition here, really isn't so much about the child, but the rights of an adult to be considered a parent. That's a very different thing. Taken together, these two stories also help to complete a picture that we need to see, and that is that this giant revolution that is taking place is technology-driven morality and morally licensed technology. You put the two of them together, you really understand you can't have the one without the other. The technological revolution that now includes opportunities for tampering with the genomic, that is, the genetic structure of human beings, this is something that has never existed before. A part of that is merely technological. The process, the science, the technology did not exist before. As a matter of fact, these didn't exist just a matter of months ago in terms of usable technologies, but they do exist now. But we also note that they were morally licensed. All the previous steps had to overcome moral scrutiny and moral boundaries that previous generations would have recognized as being matters of right and wrong. All that's now transcended. Given the dynamic, we are told that if a technology can happen, it must happen. And then the argument, which no doubt was very influential in Britain concerning this experiment, that if we do not do it, if we don't license it, if our scientists don't conduct the research, someone else will, and who knows what they will do with it. There's also a commercial application to this. Don't miss that fact. There's big money behind this opportunity. There will be an entire new branch of reproductive medicine that comes out of this. But in the legal issue, we also have to recognize how sad this is. It's another domino falling, and it falls directly traceable to the Obergefell decision legalizing same-sex marriage in 2015, even as there were those who said at the time, this will inevitably happen. Others said, it doesn't necessarily happen. Now we know it already has happened. But we also have the recognition that the issues that happen in the law do not happen independently of the law, and what happens as a precedent in the state of New York will not stay in New York. Here you have the redefinition of the family in just one state. Now you have three parents with one child. That's a math that will be infectious. It will be a matter traced state by state across the map. Finally, in terms of this week in history, 100 years ago this week, some of the most momentous events in the history of the world took place. It's a symptom of our time that the 100th anniversary has come with so little attention. 100 years ago this week, Nicholas II, the Tsar of Russia, abdicated his throne and gave up the Russian Empire in what was then known as the February Revolution. Then came, quickly on its heels, the October Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, that brought about the horrors of the Soviet Union. But looking back 100 years ago, by the way, that February Revolution was according to the old Russian calendar. It actually took place in what's now recognized as March. That was a revolution that ended one of the longest monarchies in Western history, the Romanov dynasty in Russia. But here's where we also need to recognize how fast our world has changed. If you rewind history just 100 years, it wasn't just the Russians, the teeming over 100 million Russians. It was virtually all of Europe, the vast majority of the population of Europe, that was under the crowned head of a monarch, most of them under autocratic monarchies. The Habsburg monarchy that ruled Austria-Hungary, the Hohenzollern dynasty that ruled in Prussia and later throughout all of Germany. But you also had constitutional monarchies such as the House of Windsor in the United Kingdom. That's still the ruling house, the ruling family in that nation. But there's a vast difference between a constitutional monarchy. The monarch in the United Kingdom is basically a ceremonial figure, the head of state, but not the head of government, and the autocracies that were headed by emperors and kings and czars even 100 years ago. Now just consider the vast social change that has taken place in just 100 years. You have Europe transitioning from the rule by hereditary autocratic monarchs to most of Europe under some form of constitutional democracy. But in that 100 years, you also had plenty of horror. Not only two massive murderous world wars, but also the murderous regime of the Soviet Union and the horrifying reality of the Soviet bloc and life behind, as it was known, the Iron Curtain. One of the most interesting aspects in the verdict of history is how little attention this is getting in contemporary Russia. There's a reason for that. Russia is once again under the rule of an effective autocrat, in this case, President Vladimir Putin. He has nothing to gain by celebrating a revolution that toppled an autocrat. Furthermore, many Russians today do not look back at the Romanov dynasty, particularly in its last 100 years, as anything like a golden era. Almost by any definition, Nicholas II was one of the least competent monarchs in modern European history. But Vladimir Putin also does not want in any way to encourage romanticizing about revolution. One autocrat does not celebrate the fall of another autocrat. There is also the embarrassment, the humiliation to Russia of the interregnum of the Soviet Union between 1917 and 1989. It was 100 years ago this week that with Russia coming apart at the seams and with revolution on just about every major urban street, the Tsar of all the Russias, as he was known, the last reigning Romanov emperor, abdicated his office. He abdicated in favor of his own brother Michael, who, in one sense, ruled, if at all, for only 24 hours. Before long, most of the leading members of the Romanov family, including the Tsar, the Tsarina Alexandra, and their children, had been murdered by the Bolsheviks. It was clear back in 1917 that most Americans, including those in national office, weren't exactly sure what to think about the fall of the Romanov dynasty. It wasn't clear if this was going to lead to greater or lesser freedom and prosperity for the Russian people. But there's no excuse now for not understanding the rightful verdict on what happened in 1917. It was an unmitigated disaster for Russia and, by extension, to a great deal of the world beyond. And yet it would come as a shock, I think, to most Americans today to understand that just 100 years ago, at a time when Woodrow Wilson was actually president of the United States, vast teeming millions of Europeans and others around the world were ruled by autocratic monarchs. Most of those kings, we need to note, have passed away, certainly as autocrats. In 1948, King Farouk of Egypt remarked, quote, "The whole world is in revolt. Soon there will be only five kings left, the King of England, the King of Spades, the King of Clubs, the King of Hearts, and the King of Diamonds," end quote. He lost his own throne in 1952. But even if the reign of autocratic monarchs has mostly come to an end, the reign of autocrats has not. All you need for confirmation of that is to look to Russia today, and therein lies the warning. Just because the lessons of history are there for all to see, doesn't mean that the lessons of history are well learned. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.